Okay.
We got a shaking going on here. Hi, everybody. My name is Joe Arechiga. I'm an alcoholic. I'm really glad to be here today, safe, sane, and sober. It's good to see all you folks here. I just met Kathy and some of you folks, and boy, it's nice. You know, it's always good to go to a place where AA, where you're accepted and loved. I mean, you know, it wasn't like that when I was drinking, as some of you may attest to. You know, but I really like the little cairns you got on the tables and this emblem. You know, these things, I'm a hiker, Bishop, California, Mammoth Lakes, I got sober in, and those little things are trail markers. They're called ducks or cairns, trail ducks or cairns. And it's like I needed a lot of trail markers when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of ways to show me where I'm going and what I'm doing. So a little background, as a kid growing up in the Palo Alto area, very nervous kid, right? I'm restless and irritable from the get-go. I'm always that kid. Sit down, be still, stop it, quit touching that, put that back. You know, come over here. You need to. And boy, I was hard to control. You know, I found out later from my brother that they put me in kindergarten as a 4-year-old, and I was very immature to be there. And so that back then, in the late 50s and early 60s, they tried to control you with ping pong paddles and yardsticks and rulers, and I got the yellow rope, and then these handmade paddles as I got a little older. And it didn't help me. I didn't like authority. Don't tell me what to do. I don't know. I'm just a kid and I don't know. And as I was growing up in that area, though, there were times when this time of year, I'd go out and I would find the mustard fields, the flowers, just out there. And that's when I could be still. When I'm out in nature like that, I found I could be still. I'd watch the red-winged blackbirds fly around, and I could be still. And I could even be still in church. You know, I went to church, and we would sing. I loved it. Mass, sing in Latin. We'd do all that stuff, and I liked it. I could be still right then. But, you know, of course, she was there. You know, the other little girl that I'd had first communion with lived down the street. We learned to be doctors. You know? I really liked her too, you know. But her dad didn't like me. He came over looking for me one night. My mom told me this story. I don't remember this. Said I lit out the back of the house, jumped the fence and down the alley before he could even, "Where's that Joe? Where's that little Joey?" You know, and then she came as later, she told me, yeah, and she kept coming back. I never knew what happened to her, you know, but those are kind of the things that I was living with as a kid. I'm restless, irritable, and discontent from the very beginning. It's not an easy thing to be like that. And, you know, my brother started showing me how to steal cough medicine from the 7-Eleven and drinking that. It had codeine and 30% alcohol in it, man. And that had an effect produced. I'm like 8 years old, okay? I have kids and I have grandkids. I can't imagine them doing that stuff. But, you know, I was doing it. And I didn't drink till I was 10. You know, I know that's a little late for some of you guys. But, you know, it just happened that way. And the effect produced by alcohol in me was so powerful that I wanted to do more. I didn't realize in the beginning, I was that restless, irritable kid, and it gave me a feeling of calm, and I'm somebody. You know, I had these two bigger brothers, and, you know, I had become somebody. It made the world go from black and white to color. I know some of you in here might remember black and white TVs. Man, when they got color, it was like, oh my God, you know, this is a whole different thing. And that's what the effect produced in me in alcohol. It's one of the things I chased for many, many years. And that obsession that I could get that back is what drove me to the gates of insanity and death. I didn't know I had this other component of alcoholism, the first one being that there's going to, you know, when I honestly want to, I find I can't quit entirely. You know, that's that obsessive mind. That's the thing that's going to make me drink again. But this other component, I had no idea until I came to AA, that physical allergy to alcohol that I craved more when I started drinking. I didn't know that. I came to Alcoholics on March 20th of 92, and I had no idea that I had a physical craving for alcohol. Those guys schooled me on that. I hope you guys are schooled. I hope there's some newcomers here that they know what alcoholism is. It's not because I crashed my car and got DUIs or ended up in a domestic violent court or whatever it might be. Those things, yes, those are consequences of my drinking. But what makes me an alcoholic is my obsession to have some more. And then once I drink, I can't control the amount I take. And that's very important that I understand that. I didn't know that when I came there. Well, I lived in Mammoth Lakes, I met my wife, we had kids, and I'm drinking, and just to make it quick, I'm insane. I can't stand myself, I can't make a living, I can't pay the rent, I'm spending all my money on booze and then some of that Peruvian marching powder that we got around. You know, I just, you know, it's all about me. I'm so self-centered and so egotistical that I didn't really care about the family, what was going on there. And a couple things happened. My father-in-law came over. I'm living on a little place that we lovingly call the ghetto in Mammoth Lakes. And it's called that for a reason. And he lived in a little A-frame. And he came over to see his daughter, my wife. And he comes over, and it's just a mess. I'm a mess. The whole house is a mess. Everything's a mess. And he called it deplorable conditions. That's one of those moments of, oh my God, he was being honest with me. And it hit me to my core. Oh God, deplorable conditions. I have all these kids. There's three or four of them running around. And I'm not paying. I got to beg the landlord to not kick us out. I got to ask the lady at the Edison, please don't turn off the power, all that kind of stuff. And I got liquor stores that they won't let me in the bars anymore, but the liquor stores still give me credit, unfortunately, sometimes. So then I'm crazy. I just hate my guts. I've gotten to this point where if you're new, you understand this. The last few years of drinking, it's just like I'm crazy. I'm running down the street. You drive too fast on my street. I got an axe, and I'm chasing you. I chase people in their car, and I'm running down. And I'm not a vision for you, right? I'm swollen. I'm like a big sausage with arms and legs, you know. And I got sweatpants on, and they don't have a string, and I can't hold my pants up. And I'm running down the street, and, you know, and one guy, I'll never forget this, I ran down the street, and I had a shovel this time, no axe. And I was beating on his door, and later he would tell me he peeked out the window and saw me there, and he thought, oh my God, this guy's insane. And later he was in one of the local rehabs in Mammoth, and he saw me there. I was taking a meeting in there, and he goes, man, if you can stay sober, anybody can. You know, you're insane, you know. That's where, you know, it took me. I'm so full of guilt and shame and remorse, and I don't even know that I have these resentments, these fears, these feelings of insecurity, all that stuff that I'd find out later. And at the end, you know, my wife's calling the cops on me. My boss is sending me home from work because I've soiled myself. I'm a mess. I've been gone for days. And it just came to that point where I needed help. And this is that honest thing that we do in that first step. I got to come to the realization that I can't do this on my own. As many times as we try, I know we all try not to drink again. You know, this time only a couple. You know, in chapter 3, he says it. You know, taking a trip, not taking a trip. I'm going here. I'm drinking only wine. I'm drinking only whoopee parties, whatever it might be. I try not to do it. And when I honestly want to, I can find that I can't quit entirely. I'm on the floor. I've been dry heaving. I'm sick. I can't get up anymore. And I honestly want to quit. And I find that I can't quit entirely. It's torturous. It's torturous. And it came to that spot, and the guy, I went to work that day, and I'm sick, and I'm dying, and I remembered I had gone to DUI class and these and AA back in 86 and 87, and I went to this guy's house, and it was March 20th of 92, and there was still a lot of snow. It's in Mammoth Lakes, and he had blown his walkway, you know, and I had to walk up his walkway, and this is the long walk, the honest long walk that I had to take. That day is my first day of sobriety. And I went and knocked on his door, and I told him I need help. He got all excited. That's what we do. You're new. You need help? Yeah. He's going, oh, you do? There's a meeting here. There's a meeting at noon. You know, we're going to do this. We're going to do that. And he's all excited. And I'm like, man, I'm going to start dry heaving again. Leave me alone. You know, what are we going to do here? Go to a meeting. I want to kill myself every day. I feel like I got a gun in my head all the time. And he takes me to that meeting. I end up at that meeting. And the guys are great. I know it's small town. I know everybody in the room. I can't look at them. I can only look at the floor. This is it. I'm done. I can't. There's never going to be anything left at life. And that's an honest admission at that time. That's as honest as I can get. That I can't do this anymore, I need help. Yeah. They gave me a book. You know, I'm that guy, don't look at me, don't touch me, don't talk to me, but don't leave me alone. And they come up and they go, we got a book. And I'm thinking, what's a book gonna do? You know, all I can do is I'm like, almost in tears and I'm sick, and what's a book gonna do to help me? I took that book, I think Tom still has it. It's all marked up and everything. I've had a lot of books, but they gave me that book, and then they said, you've got to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Oh, no, no, it was hard enough to come to this meeting. I don't want to go to this meeting. I don't want to be at any meeting, and I don't want to see you anymore, and don't talk to me. And I went outside, and one of the old timers that I've known him for years, he put his arm around me, and he says, why don't you just try one meeting a day? And I thought, okay, I'll go to one meeting. I started going to meetings. You know, I was sober that day. I started going to meetings. They railroaded me into doing a Thursday night men's meeting. And I said, okay. And they gave me the key to this place. This is a house, you know, and it's empty. It's supposed to be a men's halfway house, but no one's living there. They gave me the key to the place. I went home to my wife, and I said, they gave me the key to the house. And she goes, they did what? They gave you a key to the house? How can that be? You know, she didn't trust me. No one trusted me, but you did. You gave me the key. Because if I burn it, then I'm the one who's going to suffer. I'm the one who's going to drink. Yeah, I might rip you off a little bit or whatever, but I'm the one who's going to pay the consequences. They gave me the key, and I started doing that. And I'll never forget, at 45 days sober, okay, I'm not doing any steps. I'm going to meetings, and I'm crazy. I haven't not drank in 45 days. That's been a long time since I haven't drank. I'm dry as a popcorn, man. I am ready to explode. And there's this one guy, he would come from out of town, and he would go to that men's meeting. I knew where he lived, and I went to his house. And this is what I remember. I love Peter. His name's Peter. I knocked on his door, and I'm like, veins in my neck, and I need help. And he opens his door, and he looks at me, and it's like, what are you doing here? And I'm like, I need help. I'm going to blow my brains out. I hate my guts. What am I going to do? That was an honest admission right there. That is so downright. I would never tell you that I couldn't handle it. I would never tell you that I can't do this. And I went to him, and I swear, this is what I remember. He stuck his head out the door like this, and he looked left, and then he looked right. And he, like, does anybody see you here? He grabs me, he pulls me in, and he says, get in here. We sit down, and he breaks out the book. Okay, there it is again, that book. And he breaks out the book, and he opens it up, and he says, well, looks like you need to do the third step prayer. And I said, okay. Later, he would tell me that, you know, my admission of my my bottom, my powerlessness over alcohol, my unmanageable life, and that I came to AA, was that power greater than me? And then when I went to him, I had made a decision to really reach out and get help, you know, not run this thing on my own will. You know, my own thinking, my own actions, my own life were brought me to the gates of insanity and death. And he took me out to the park. And we got on our knees. We do the third step prayer. He opened the book. I'm sure he memorized it, but he opened the book, and I had a book, and we read it out of the book, holding hands like this. I'm looking around. Who's going to see me here? I know everybody in town practically, or I think I do, and oh my God, they're going to see me holding hands with this guy and on my knees. Oh God. It's demoralizing a little bit, and I think that's where we find the humility. A lot of the stuff we do here brings me more and more to being humble. And we went back to his house, and I said, well, what do I got to do next? I didn't have a big awakening doing that, reading that in a book. Nothing happened, really. I'm just a crazy man, and I need help. And I said, what do I got to do next? And he says, next, we got to do the fourth step. We launch on a course of vigorous action. You know, at once. You know, though the third step is vital, it will have little permanent effect unless at once following a survey of yourself, you know, that inventory. And find out what the things are blocking me. This is where I listened to Chuck C, and he would say, uncover, discover, and discard. And this is where I start uncovering what Joe is. What had I become? That person I had become. And I want to discard those things that were part of my makeup. I wrote down three paragraphs right then and there. Now remember, I'm about 45 days sober. I write three paragraphs and I share it with him. These are things that are going to go to the grave. Everyone in my family knew about them. I didn't think anybody knew. They all knew about them, man. You know, all these things that I've been doing and scaring my family and the axe incidents and chopping up my kids' toys on the porch in a blind, drunken rage, scaring the neighbors, you know, that kind of stuff. And even more, not in the resentments I had. And I read them to him. And I didn't know this, but after I had talked to him about that and I was embarking on a thorough inventory right after that, he said, you know, I felt like this might work. It honestly did. When I was doing confession as a kid, I'd sit there and my brothers were in front of me. We'd go on Saturdays, every Saturday, for, you know, as long as they'd made me go to church. And I'd sit there and I'd watch my brother go in there and I'd go, I know he's lying. I just know he's lying. I know what he's doing. He's lying because he would go over and do his penance and he'd be out of there. I'm going, he's lying. And then my other brother would go in there, and I know he's lying. So I'd go in there and lie. I learned how to lie. I'm not that kid who goes up to your door and says, yeah, my soccer ball just went through your living room window, and it broke the window, and it was me. I'm not that kid. I'm running. I'm off and running. I do not want to confront this stuff. I'm done. But when I confronted it that day, I had that feeling that maybe the drink problem had been removed. It tells me in the book, it says, if I'm not honest with somebody, I'm not going to live long or happily, period. I didn't know that either, but later I would read it. He would show that stuff to me, and these are the things that really brought me to being honest. So right after that, I was, 90 days sober, and my sister calls me out of the blue. I have four brothers and a sister, and she calls me up, and she goes, oh, I'm just checking to see if you're going to the family reunion. And I go, what? And she goes, uh-oh, click. I go, what family reunion? I get all excited and no one, you know, they won't answer my phone calls. My family, you know, I threatened to hurt my brother. I did a lot of bad stuff. And so I go to Peter. I said, Peter, they're having a family reunion. They didn't invite me. They invited my older brother, the one who lied in the confessional. Then he did time in San Quentin, Soledad, and all that stuff. You know, I watched him do his thing, and I was there with him. I didn't go to prison like that, but he did. And they're inviting him and his wife and his kids. I go, this is a bad slap in the face. What's going on here? And Peter, he says, Joe, let's look at the record. Didn't you share with me about going to South Lake Tahoe to your brother's wedding a couple years ago? I said, yeah. And he goes, remind me what happened. I drank the whole way up, got there, I'm drunk, got in a fight with my next younger brother, and then the youngest brother who got married, his wife, and we're out in the parking lot scuffling. We're fighting. Everybody's in their tuxedos and stuff, and we're fighting. I never did good at weddings when I was drinking. The reception was the funnest part, and I'd black out, and I know, oh my God. So I got my brother in a headlock, and I'm punching him, and I look over, and there's my mom, and she has my one-year-old son with her, and her mouth is open. That look, my mom always gave that look. Oh my God. You know, with her mouth open, and she's holding the kid. My dad's, you know, going to come over. My younger brother, who just got married, is taking his jacket off. He's going to whip me. And then I look over at my brand-new sister-in-law, and all I can think of is, welcome to the family. You know, and he goes, well, Joe, what sort of mental health would your family have if they invited you to this family reunion? Oh, God. That, you know, they say the truth is going to set you free. It's going to hurt. It's going to hurt. That really hurt. It got me in to, you know, looking at my defects, but also getting into the amends. You know, I needed to get into the amends. I wrote my oldest brother, who was he was the first resentment on my list, my older brother. And I wrote him an honest letter. It tells you can do that in the book. Write an honest letter. Well, I don't recommend that because you don't see him. I don't see him. I didn't know how he responded, man. I didn't hear. He never said a word to me about that. He was still, I had done some damage. And so finally, a couple years later, I got to see him. And I made the family was there camping or whatever it was. And it just didn't work. It took 9 years for him to come to my house in Mammoth and actually tell me what had really happened and what he felt. That's a long period of reconstruction ahead, man. And when he got honest with me and my sister-in-law, it was like, oh my God, I'm 9 years sober and I'm bawling like a baby on the couch in the house. I can't believe I did that stuff. It's a friend of mine, we were talking the other day, and I've lived many different lives, you know, from a teenage drunk, I was an alcoholic teenager, to later, and then a married drunk, and then I get sober, and then different lives between 5 and 10 and 15 years sober, you change. You change a lot. And I can't, at 9 years sober, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. This is very painful stuff. When people are honest with you, and you feel that, and there's more amends to be made. So, and concerning the family, it was hard. I was just like that tornado. Sweet relationships are ripped up. Everything is down on the ground. You know, everybody's afraid of me. They didn't know what's going to happen with me. You know, if I'm drunk, even sober. Even today, my wife goes, have you eaten? You get that? You're hungry, angry, lonely, tired? Yeah, my daughter, you know. Dad, have you eaten? We need to feed you. We don't want you to get cranky, Dad. You know, don't get cranky, you know. And that still goes on, but I want to take the kids. So I remembered as a kid, man, camping with my family. It was one of the funnest things I ever did. You know, I was camping with the family. I didn't realize how hard it was. Tent camping, you know. So, and we're really getting the gift. I actually had a little bit of credit, and I got one of those SUV vans, you know. What is it, a family van I got. And I couldn't believe I had that car. And the other car that I had was one of those alcoholic cars. You know, you see them around, a headlight. You got to roll the window down to open the door. Stuff like that, you know, that's what I drove. Muffler hanging off. You start it up and the dogs start howling, that kind of thing. But so I get this, the caravan, and I said, well, you know, I get my wife on board. And we're going to go take the kids camping. So So we go up, and no reservations, nothing. I just take off, Northern California on the coast, up to Oregon, and up into Washington. And I've been going, it was about a year and a half sober, I've been going to meetings every day. I am in contact with my sponsor every day because I see him. And I got his phone, but you know, back then you don't have flip phones, smartphones, anything like that. You don't have the access that you do today. You cannot just go online and go, oh, there's a meeting here. There's a meeting here tonight. No, you can't do that. So I didn't go to meetings for like 10 days. This is not a good thing for Joe. No meetings for Joe, no contact with alcoholics. That's a bad deal. So I'm going down, we got this van, this minivan. I'm going across the bridge in Oregon. And one of the, my son, I had got him these goggles and a snorkel, and he's got the window cracked, and it's whistling, really high-pitched whistle. I'm already irritated, you know, I'm tired, overworked, underpaid, underloved, that kind of thing, and it's whistling. And then the youngest baby, she poo-poo pants, and then the other girl, she pukes because she smells the puke, you know, the poopy pants. And I, you know, I'm like, oh, my God. And I'm looking, I'm driving along, I look at my wife, and I'm like, I started doing the Charlie Manson look. Oh. And she goes, that's it, we're getting a hotel, because, you know, we were poor. We're, you know, a hotel was out of league. And so we decided to get the hotel. So we go to the hotel. First of all, we go to the grocery store, because you're going to take groceries in. You got to feed these kids, and you got to feed me. So we go in there, and I find myself standing in front of the non-alcoholic beer. I mean, back then it was near beer. I think they have so many brands now, I don't even care. And, you know, I'm standing there and looking at it, and I look at my wife, and I said, I've never had a non-alcoholic beer. And she goes, that's it. You're calling somebody right now. We got all these kids, and we go out there with that basket, and we're sitting there by the phone. It's a pay phone. You know, she goes, you're calling somebody. I end up having to call the cops, the sheriff. And we're in this, you know, rural town, and you don't have access to the inner group or AA hotline or anything like that. So I call, and they say, yeah, you got to call the sheriff. So I call the sheriff, and he goes, well, where are you staying? And I told him the hotel. He knew the hotel. He knew the phone number of, they didn't have phones in that hotel, but they had a payphone outside the office. He goes, I know that phone number. I'll have the guy from AA call you. And I said, really? He says, yeah, just wait near the phone. So we go there, and my wife takes the kids to the pool, and I, you know, no screen on the window. I'm hanging out the window of the room, and I'm looking at the phone. This little, well, we'll call it a C motel. And I'm looking at the phone, and here comes this poor guy. He's walking up, and he looks like he's going to look on the phone. He's going to the phone. I started looking at him with Charlie Manson eyes. What are you doing, you know? He looked at me and turned around and left. I'm not sure if he was going to the phone or what he was doing, but he sure got the message. You know, it's amazing what that, the body language does. And then the phone rang. I jump out the window, and I'm over there on the phone, and he says, oh, is this is Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, oh, yeah, I need a meeting. And he goes, oh, you're lucky tonight. They have one meeting a week in that area. You're lucky tonight. He says, if you look right across the street, he knew where I was at that phone booth, right? And he goes, if you look right across the street or across the highway there, there's a little brown building. That's a church. He says, tonight at 7:30, they have a meeting. And I thought, oh, my God, how does that happen? So I'm going to the meeting, right? I go to the meeting. And I'm standing in line. I'm all happy now because, you know, just it's like drinking. You know you're going to have a drink. It's going to be there. And I start feeling it. I'm getting it going. Yeah, I haven't even drank it yet. I go to the meeting, and it's like, man, I'm feeling better already. I'm not so crazy. And I get in line, and an old-timer, kind of like me now, I guess, he turns around. He goes, oh, you're on vacation. I said, yeah, I'm on vacation. I got there. I'm camping, and everything's great, you know. And I didn't tell him that an hour earlier I wanted to maybe off the family and drop them off, you know. And he looked at me, and he goes, oh, man. He gave me his honest experience, and he said, those are going to be the best memories you'll ever have. And his honesty went right in my heart. I'll never forget that guy. You know, how we are together. He was right. I'll never forget that. That was a great memory. And as we were going on here, so I got about, okay. So after that, about 2010, I had gone up to a conference in Tahoe, and it was 75 years of miracles. It's 75 years of Alcoholics Anonymous. At the International, it was going to be 75 years that year. And went up to a conference up there, and a guy, Sandy B, some of you might know him, and Bob B were there. And it's a very intimate setting at the Cal Neva up there. It was really nice. And Sandy's daughter had been just murdered. She was killed. And he shared his honest experience with that, of how it went with him. And that the first thing he did was accept the situation exactly how it was and forgive the perpetrator, not knowing who the perpetrator was, and he never found out, but forgive them immediately. It's like the resentment. If you let that resentment dig in, it's harder to get out, just harder to get rid of if I keep digging it in my head. And he said, you know, immediately forgive and know that it's not going to change my relationship with God. He's, you know, and he went and talked a long time about that, and very powerful. And he shared some things. I think if some of you might remember when the Amish thing happened up in Pennsylvania, and all those kids got killed by the gunman, and then the gunman shot himself. And the next day, the parents of the Amish kids who had been murdered went over and consoled the perpetrator's parents. Amazing, just amazing how that works. And there was another one where the kid, you know, blasted. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and he got shot. And the media was there sticking the phone or the microphone right in this lady's face, waiting for her to, you know, break down. And they go, well, what do you think of the murderer of your son? And she says, I've already forgiven him. End of story. End of the person on the other end of the microphone's like, what? How does that work? I didn't know that this lesson, this experience was going to happen. In 2013, my oldest daughter is pregnant. She's 8 months pregnant. And I had some friends in San Diego, and they got her and her new husband a little place down there. And they're going to move in. And, you know, they're all happy, you know, new couple, they're going to have the baby and all that stuff. My wife and I helped them out a bit. And that day they were putting up pictures on the wall, a little hammer. And that's, I almost said sucker. That, my son-in-law attacked her with the hammer. Some reason, we didn't know at the time, he had a schizophrenic event. And he had the hammer, and he started beating on her. He hit her in the head a few times, and she's able to block some blows, and she ran out of the place, and he tackled her. And he was strangling her. She doesn't remember a thing. And I was in a Monday night meeting. It was a Monday night, and I did the secretary to 12 and 12, and this is in Mammoth Lakes. And I came out, I leave my phone in the car, and I looked at my phone. I had all these voicemails and all these text messages, and I didn't know what happened. And boy, you feel a little panic coming up. And you can't find them. When you do domestic violence, they will not let you know where they are, where the victim is. They don't let you know. So we found out my middle daughter, she called her with a nurse's phone, and there was down there in San Diego somewhere, and she went there, and we found out. And he was in jail. It looked like he was going to go to prison on two accounts of attempted murder, and she was in the hospital, and the baby and her were okay. She was bruised up a bit, had some, you know, swelling in the head and that kind of thing. And so as soon as we could, I went down there. My youngest daughter came with me. And I went with my oldest daughter, and we went down to the DA's down there in San Diego. I don't know if you guys know that. But it's like, it is a fortress. It's almost like the prison. If you go into a county jail or something, it's almost like that, not quite like that. But you have to have a permit to drive underneath. It's domestic violence, man. They think you, perpetrator, man, you're going to go there and finish them off. That's what happened. But you go down there and you go up the secure elevator, they check you out, and then you go in and there's bulletproof glass everywhere. And in this waiting room where they're running my license and my daughter's license. And as I waited, I walked around the room. It was a nice room. And on the plaques, there was these plaques on the wall. And underneath them were these stories of the victims of these perpetrators. And I started reading them. And I thought, oh my God, that's me. I scared my wife a lot. I scared the kids. I did all this stuff. And it was another one of those things that truth came out through what was written on those things. And I had to honestly look at that again and again, because I was that guy. When at the end of my drink, and I had a carving knife out, and I was chasing my wife around with it in a blackout. And I couldn't believe it. And then my daughter, you know, that stuff. And we went through that, and they got through with it. And then they had more kids. I mean, you know, he got out, and oh my God. It's another, you know, I don't like it. Kids are living with us now. Grandkids live with me and my wife up in Bishop. And, you know, there's good and bad. I got to be honest with that. You know, sometimes it's like, oh my God, they got to go. And then other times it's like, I go pick them up from school, and it's like, oh, Grandpa. You know, that I'm a little weak in that area. Anyway, this is a different incident, and I was about 3.5, 4 years sober. I had a new neighbor come over. And this lady, she's a nice lady. She was not the belle of the ball. She turned out not to be such a nice lady. But we made friends. They had a couple kids about the same age as mine at the time. I'm newly sober, 3.5, 4 years. And this is a real big deal. And she came over one day, a nice day, and she's a little sultry, a little suave coming in there. And then she kind of, you know, doing this and that. I'm newly sober, and you know, and she's trying to suck me in as far as I could tell. You know, we went over, the kids are playing in the house, I'm over on the side of the house, and she's showing me some cleavage, and she's going on, and all of a sudden, my zipper was down. It's like, oh my God, and when the zipper goes down, pop goes the weasel, you know, and I'm sitting there, and I'm starting to think with my little head, and she walked away, and I thought, oh my God, what happened there? And nothing happened till the next day. I'm at work, and the police investigator comes. He wants my account of the whole thing. Well, maybe went a little too far there. And so I lie. What else do you do? I lied. I just said, I didn't do it. And the next day, after that, he wrote the deposition for me. Next day, my daughter comes home, and she's crying. And I said, well, what happened? And the son of that daughter was bullying her at school. He says, your dad's going to jail. Your dad's going to jail. And he got the shopping cart and he hurt her. Oh, I'm a little angry. I'm pissed off. And I'm out there and I'm chopping a little kindling, you know, and he comes out. And I got the axe in my hand. He comes out and looks at me and I give him the Hulk with the axe in my hand. And he runs back in the house. Can't blame him. He runs back in the house, the cops show up, it's a big deal. My wife's screaming at the cop, screaming at the woman. I'm kind of hiding. No, I didn't do it. Didn't do nothing. You know, I'm sober. I've gotten to this point where I need to be constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself. I got to grasp and develop a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty at that point. So I'm with Dwayne. And I called Dwayne, my sponsor's out of town, so I call this guy Dwayne. And I told him what's happening. And I said, you know what I'm gonna do? I'm gonna go get a bottle of tequila and this is gonna end ugly. I'm gonna dive through their window with that axe and I'm gonna go nuts. And that's what I wanted to do. And he says, I'll come over and get you. So I said, you gonna help me? But he does, he comes and gets me, and we go to South Lake Tahoe again, and we go to a fall festival up there, and the whole way we talk. And he says, Joe, you haven't molded your ideals, the ideals in your sex conduct. You don't have these ideals. You need to get these ideals. And he goes, ideals are like stars. He goes, you'll never touch them with your hands. But like the seafaring man on the desert of oceans, they will be your guides. And if you follow them, you will find your destiny. My destiny at that time was spiritual awakening. I didn't, you know, I said, yeah, I'm going to use them as my guides. And he goes, you got to go tell the truth. So I call the investigator. He comes over. Small town, remember? I'm afraid. I mean, everybody knows me. Everybody knows my kids, all that stuff. I don't think they knew that had happened yet. And so I call the investigator, and I tell him my side of the story. And he says, okay, I got to take this in, and I got a lawyer. A lot of stuff happened. And after I told the truth in this thing, I felt such a relief. Dang, it's going to cost me some money. Maybe I'll, have a certificate, something will happen. But what happened was the DA called me at the first time, and I lied to him. And I knew the DA. I knew when he was the assistant DA, because when I was drinking, I knew the cops, I knew the DA, I knew the judges, all that good stuff. And he says, well, you want to take a lie detector test? No. I didn't, I said, would I have to? And then that's when Dwayne said, you got to tell the truth. So I rewrote the whole thing and got really honest with what had happened. And I needed, man, this was a big deal. I had to make amends to my wife. As I did this and I went to court, and I ended up paying a big fine and doing all these community service and stuff, I realized that, I really need some different ideals. I need to change these things. And Dwayne helped me with that. And as I did that, the judge who gave me the sentence, I knew him. Later on, after I had told the truth, that judge and I became friends. His kids bought my kids skis. They're all on the race team, and they're racing. And I'd see him at the post office, and, hey, Joe. Later on, when I'm doing PI and CP work, this is all a result of being honest. I'm doing PI and CP work probably, I don't know, maybe 10 years later. He invites me to the courthouse. He has the other judges there. He's got the DA, the assistant DA, all the people in probation. He's got public defenders and everything. And I did a presentation of what AA is and what it isn't and how can we cooperate. Does that happen to a guy who they just did sentence on, who was, close to being a sex offender, that close? And I knew I wasn't a sex offender because they did a background check on me, and I started coaching Little League and soccer and all that stuff, and there was no problems there. And in that process of being honest, coming clean with that situation, it opened up a whole different world for me. I never want to forget that. And the judge was very kind to me about that. And I want to talk about a little bit about getting honest about my situation with my oldest brother. My oldest brother, I swear he's a hard drinker. When I'm reading a book with somebody and it talks about the average tempered drinker and the hard drinker and the real alcoholic, I thought my brother was a real alcoholic like me, this brother, the second older brother. We drank, we fought, we got put in juvie, we got kicked out of school, all that stuff together. And I thought, God, this guy's an alcoholic like me. But, he got married. He fell in love. He can drink 2 Budweiser. That pisses me off. I look at him. Is it okay if I drink in front of you? Yeah. It's my brother, Steve. He's a really nice guy. But he's the one who sent me the letter. He sent me a letter. And I had gone down to Tucson to visit him. And I had that beater car, and I had only 2 kids. We went down there, and he took me to Nogales, and he started feeding me shots of this special tequila. And the first shot came, he goes, this is really good tequila. And I go, Steve, when I drink tequila, anything can happen. And he goes, oh, it'll be okay. It'll be okay. Well, it wasn't okay. You know, I got drunk, got lost. I don't even know how I got through the border. I got my wife and these two kids in the car, and I'm lost. I lose it. I punch the windshield out. I go to his, I end up at his house, and I'm calling back home because I got, I want a guy to FedEx me some marching powder because I need to stay drunk more and all that crap. And he wouldn't do it. And I'm beating the phone on the, you know, I scare my wife's crying. His wife's afraid of me. And he is too. You know, he's a big dude. I'm a runt. He's big dude. And he's afraid of me. Finally, we left. He, you know, I had to leave. And I got home and he had written me a letter. Called me an alcoholic. Oh, God. Says, Joe, you got to stop drinking. You're an alcoholic. And these big letters. And I've always wished I would have kept that letter. I burned it. But, I think, God, I could look at it today and go, oh, that's how you were. You know, you stop drinking and that. And that's one of the reasons I didn't get invited to that family reunion. Who would want to invite me? And so I called him that night. I'm an idiot. I'm a drunken idiot, violent, hateful, bad. I call him up and I said, I'm going to come down there and kill you. And him and his wife thought that I really meant that, you know, and I guess I might have. I don't know. He hung up. That 9 years later when we sat at my house and he told my sister-in-law said, Joe, we really thought you were coming down here to kill us. God, the effect produced. I wanted to drink and be free from the bondage of Joe. And I ended up being in the bondage of hell, the bondage of Joe, and the bondage of alcoholism. And these things are hard to clean up. Anyway, I go to the jail, the county jail, for in Mono County up there. I did it for 26, 28 years. And you go up there and you meet a lot of these guys who end up in jail. And this one kid, he was in the halfway house. And Nate, I really love Nate. You know, but he ended up in jail. He was a drunk like me. And they have a night of lights there, big party. He got drunk. And then he's running around naked out there. And it's like, you know, minus zero somewhere. It's December. They have this big party in the mountains in the snow. And they put him in jail. And I went to the jail on Sunday. And he's in there. And he's looking out, you know, because he knows me. And he's looking out, trying to look out the side of that glass. So after the meeting, by this time the jailer knows me, the sheriff knows me, all these people know me from being in Alcoholics Anonymous and going to these things and doing this stuff. And they asked me, they said, Joe, can you give him a ride home? And I said, yeah, no problem. Well, he's a little soiled and, you know, I don't care, get him in the car. So we got him in the car, and on the way home, it's about 50 miles drive. On the way home, he starts opening up to me like I did Peter when Peter asked me, you know, write this four-step thing, and I opened up. And he started telling me of the abuse that he went through with his family. He's from Missouri, and he's, you know, his father's abuse and these things. He's really being honest, I could tell. And I felt it in here because that's me. He's like me. And we get back there, and I get him a place to stay for the night. And I get him something to eat. And the next day, Monday, he had gone to the mental health people. And he had been in the system a little bit. And next thing I knew, he was shipped down to Anaheim to the Salvation Army. And I thought, God, where'd he go? You know, and I guess that was what God wanted. That's what I thought. Well, he's in his place down there in God. Well, a couple weeks later, in January, February of that year, and I got a phone call, or I was told that he had drank too much and swallowed too many pills, and he was dead. And it just broke my heart. that poor guy, you know, he's just like me. He just, I'm sure he didn't want to commit suicide. He just drank and swallowed too many pills and didn't wake up. And I know that happens a lot. And so I'm working two jobs. I'm trying to, you know, take care of kids. I'm saving them for college, all this goofball stuff. I'm working a day job, and I'm plowing snow at night in February. And I'm working hard. And I'm the kids are home for spring break, and they're up. Two of my girls are home, and they're up in the house, and they're playing like kittens. And I'm, like, down there all resentful. Why aren't they helping me shovel this out? Why aren't they helping me clean this? Damn these kids. I could have sworn I showed them how to do this stuff. And I'm feeling, you know, underpaid, underloved, undercared for, and I'm feeling pretty low, and I was resentful. And by then, we had flip phones, you know. I got a phone call, and on the other end was this lady, and she sounded like she'd been crying, and she's on the other end. I answered the phone, even though it was an area code I didn't know, okay? I answered the phone, and so I say, hello, this is Joe. And she says, this is Nathan's mother. And I couldn't put Nathan together. And I said, Nathan, Nathan, Nathan. She goes, Nate. And I said, oh, Nate's mother. She goes, yeah, I want to thank you for trying to help Nate. And it still hits me today that this is what we do here. We try and help each other because we save lives in Alcoholics Anonymous. We do. We help each other, man. We care for each other. And this lady's crying. I'm crying. And I look up at the house, and all of a sudden, I'm all full of gratitude. And my kids are up there playing, and they're alive. And she found my card in his effects, my little AA card. And she got my phone number. And she wanted to thank me. And then I went to the group because the group knew Nate. And it was kind of a big deal in this little group that he died. And I got her address. We got cards. And we sent her cards, you know, with our feelings in there. And it was very, very powerful. And, you know, to this day, I'll never forget Nate and the honesty that he shared with me. And she asked me about that. She said, did he ever share with you the abuse that his dad put him through? And I said, yeah, he was coming around to me. And she goes, oh, thank God. He needed to. If you're going to live long and happy, you got to be honest with somebody. And that's really the truth and of what he did. And one more thing before I go here. I got a couple minutes. Little story. There's a spiritual teacher, he's languishing in a prison. This is, you know, many years ago, thousands of years ago. And he's in prison, but he hears about a spiritual master in another part of the country who's teaching and showing people a different way of life. And he sends a couple of his followers to go ask if that master is really the master. And his followers go there. And they tell him, and these guys knew each other, the teacher and the master. And the master says, well, you go back and you tell him that what you've seen here, and that's that the blind can see, the deaf can hear. I was so blind, my alcoholism. And even after getting sober, I didn't see until I could see. And then the deaf can hear. And I couldn't hear until I could hear. And the lepers are cleansed. And the poor in spirit have been given the gift. And I think that's what happens to us here in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is what happens. I can hear, I can see, and my spirit has been lifted up. And I want to thank you guys for inviting me to talk. Thank you.